everybody. I think hopefully you'll find this is an interesting bridging talk. I didn't realize it, even though we, of course, are great planning, I guess, did this. But after Dan's talk last night, I think where he's looking at some of these spawn-based FFV ideas, and then today you're going to hear more about, through Alistair and others, about finite element modeling. So we've sort of applied both. We've sort of been in the physical modeling area for a while, but we've looked at some other things recently. And so I'm going to talk to you, I'll introduce just a little bit, and then talk about the work we've been doing in the first half hour over the years, sort of a probabilistic strategy with a biomechanical model-based thing. We've used these shape features, but the idea is it could use a variety of input data. And then I'll come to more recent work. This is sort of a chronological following of some of our work where we've gone and then looked at other strategies in order to speed up some of the modeling ideas, and then reinserted or came back to some physical modeling recently using a boundary element approach, and then talk about more ideas later. But I think in general, the idea is that we're trying to find computational platforms that can integrate data and models for the sake of, in our case, primarily left ventricular deformation estimation. And I'm fortunate enough to collaborate with Al Sanusis, who you heard from before, and he has an animal lab right across the hallway from our image analysis lab, so we've had quite a nice partnership. And so we try to bridge across, use phantoms and animals and human data for our validation strategies. But in general, I hope most of the students in my lab have some appreciation of at least some of the issues we're looking at in the clinical domain or where we're headed. And I think one of the key ones that Al's posed over the years is if we have, this is a cross-section from the ventricle, and we have occlusion, that we're looking for sort of, can we somehow quantify gradation of myocardial injury as it progresses across the wall and has different levels of transmurality. So I think that's one of the goals we've kept in mind over the years. Now, we've looked at different data sources. We've been heavily in the MR camp, but not so much MR tagging, and these aren't always the best images. Maybe that's good, I don't know. But from the apex up to the base of cine gradient echo acquisitions of humans, in this case, dog hearts. We've also looked, and you'll see it as I get towards the end of the talk, and we're quite interested in four-dimensional echocardiographic images as data sources for trying to predict LV deformation. And this is for sure not the best image, but it was sort of a reminder of data from CT, cine CT data. Actually, I was fortunate enough to work with Eric Rittman a bit before the dynamic spatial reconstructor shut down. So we had a variety of data from him, including ones with dogs with implanted markers, and I'll talk about that a little bit. This is just a reminder to me, there's plenty of things going on in the tagging as data sources for tracking deformation in the MR tagging community. We've heard some of that, you're gonna hear more today. There's been work in using phase contrast velocity work. Is Van Wedeen here? I know he was. Okay, great. I knew you were coming. And I think there's some new issues maybe here, or you've been looking at that, or I don't know. But anyway, there was historical work in that. And Norbert Pelt did some, we played with it. I'm gonna talk to you about shape-based strategies. You heard from Dan Rueckert what I'll call for the moment registration strategies, and then folks in the mechanical modeling community have certainly looked at things. And so this is partly background, and we sort of touched on different areas. But by and large, I guess we finally, after maybe 10 years or so, sort of posed the base problem that we worked on in this sort of framework of trying to bring sparse data that we might get out of the sequences of any one of these modalities, and then models together to try to get dense field displacement and then strain estimation. And I guess we felt as time went on that we could pose this in a probabilistic or a Bayesian style strategy, basically as a MAP or maximum a posteriori estimation problem. That we're trying to get a set of dense set of vectors, displacement vectors U, and we've got some sparse measured vectors UM, and we'll just flip that around with Bayes' rule on the right side there. And the UM are basically the measurements, and they're noise-corrupted measurements, where UM is some underlying U plus some kind of noise. We'll make some assumptions on that, the typical assumptions, for better or worse. And if you take the logs, you can get basically an estimation problem that looks like this. And at the end, you can separate out. You've got data somehow, and you're trying to adhere to the data, and you've got some model information, and this is incorporated in a sense, or at least we can make the assumptions about what the density functions are in these. And by taking the logs, I mean, it's all going to reduce to the same kind of objective functions that many folks are using, but we'll just try to put it in this framework for moving forward and maybe capturing information in models. So the data term, as I said, individual measurements at different points. Well, I'll come back to this. We're using a particular thing here, but just assume that it's sparse measurements from the image sequences. We're modeling the measurements then, and this is sort of a gross assumption that many people invoke, and we're not any better, I guess, that the measurements are somehow statistically independent, and they're corrupted by Gaussian noise, so we'll assume that basically it's a Gaussian information. We'll ultimately concatenate all the displacements into a long vector U and the measurements into a matrix UM. And we'll include a covariance matrix in here, sigma, that is going to somehow represent confidence in the measurements. Now, we can do particular calculations, but it might be useful for different ways if you know at certain parts of the cycle, if you're putting tag data, that you know it's fading certain places, you might be confident in different, more confident in different frames. This will have a particular context for the sort of tracking features that we use. And in fact, I guess I would say that these are sort of some possible image-derived features in a broad sense that we might use for tracking. Certainly the tag planes and lines that you've heard about already, maybe phase velocity information can be used, perhaps intensity, and we think shape can be used, and that's what I'm going to talk a little bit more about. In MR, in CT, maybe intensity, maybe something to do with shade. In echo, and I'll talk a little bit about this, and others I think Fritz was talking about a little bit, might do speckle tracking. And we felt that from all these, we can get some sort of feature estimates sort of based on shape-like parameters around the surface. You'll see how we did it initially with based on segmentation, and then later on directly trying to estimate it from the intensity data itself. So I'll go with it in the first run that we actually wanted to segment surfaces. And we in 3D surfaces in each frame of a 4D data set, this is some of the, I think it's some of the DSR data, if I remember correctly. So before there were Coutts and Taylor, actually a few years before, we had an idea of a Bayesian strategy here where we could constrain using Fourier descriptors of shape to sort of priors. In this case, the prior is just an ellipsoid, and then sort of place that in the image data set and deform it to find the endocardial, the epicardial surfaces, again posed in this case in a map framework where the data are just sort of edge or contrast detected features. And you might have some range of starting shapes posed in a shape space if you can do it. But this is more of a reminder. It's sort of like, we'll take segmentation as best as anybody can do it. And even in some cases, if you have to hand trace slices and then reassemble it into smooth surfaces with all the associated errors, but the hopefully regularization of fitting smooth surfaces to things. So over the years, we gathered lots of data, and we ran these sort of semi-automated algorithms and corrected them, and gathered things up into runs of segmented surfaces, in this case from an MR and a CineCT data set. And the features that we focused on was we felt that it looked like, although there on the epicardium there's fairly smooth, although large-scale slight ripples in certain cases, on the endocardium, especially if you include the papillary muscles, there's some pretty distinct shape features. And if you can basically, if you have segmented surfaces, you can compute principal curvatures off these surfaces by fitting surface patches. And you could kind of put the squares of these together, I suppose, in a notion of bending energy. And here we're just plotting that bending energy to show you the shape features, where green means more bent and white is flatter, mapped on top of these endocardial surfaces. Now the idea here is that not that any one thing necessarily goes all the way from diastole to systole, but from instantaneously between any two frames, that there's an assumption of a preservation of shape. And so you can go around at certain scales, and we varied the scales as we worked on this, and said, okay, here's a surface patch on these segmented surfaces. That's a potential feature. You can reduce that set if you want to key things, or you can just do it blindly everywhere at a certain scale. And then at the next frame in time, there's some plausible region where that point might be able to go to. And we'll say that the matching of that then is, we'll try to match those within a search window to say, what's the shape at this, what point in time, what's the minimum, we'll assume that there's in a sort of an optical flow of shape, if you will, that it preserves it doesn't change too much at the next time point, and we'll match that and then match it at as many points as we can, and or everywhere in a sense. And so you can get these over frames, frame to frame, these sort of shape features on the endocardium, and you can just assemble them as runs of displacements. And I mean, it can just be everywhere for any pairs of frames, and the only issue is this preservation of shape between any two frames. So then if we use these as features, and this is what this initial part of the talk is based on, and we'll sort of use it throughout, but you could, I guess in the context of what I was trying to say here is the modeling and the combination of data and modeling could theoretically be any set of features. And now as we, this is sort of germane to the discussion at the end of yesterday, I think, was that what are we going to do now to kind of constrain or sort of put together this feature information to assemble dense set of features from the sparse, reliable information at only probably certain points. And you can do different things here. We initially felt, and I think in at least in this community by and large over the years, folks have looked to biomechanical modeling because there's a nice community working on that. And we felt that so by choosing the models, we want to go towards physical modeling. We're going to choose a material model invariant to the rigid motion of the spatial frame of reference. The free parameters might be roughly related to the anisotropy of the material. And so while it's not, it's at least a sufficient condition that we can model the material using some kind of an energy function that depends on the geometrical change to the strain tensor. So we set out to define a strain energy function, and this is the modeling term. So we use a strain energy function W. This is what's going to connect us to the biomechanics. And we'll pose this as a probability, a PDF, a probability density function, with a sort of a standard spatial smoothness assumption that we've got a Markov field of displacements, which allows us to produce the prior term in a Gibbs-like form like this, where again, U could be the concatenation of all the nodes. And we'll perform a meshing in this sense as we move towards between the endocardium and epicardium. So I'm not the one necessarily to be putting up these, but since I'm sort of early in the modeling piece, maybe others will do this later, let me set out a few definitions. That we have a body at time zero and time t, the LV in this case. The displacement is the small x as it changes in time minus the baseline capital X. And basically, you can, from this, by computing partial derivatives, you can define what amounts to F, a deformation tensor. And you can show that over all points I and j, it reduces to something like this. And furthermore, you can show that the strain is essentially the inner product of this deformation tensor minus the identity matrix. So between any two frames, then, we have used the infinitesimal assumption that changes in strain between any two time frames is less than 3 to 5% everywhere, although we move some of this to the finite strain cases, but it didn't show too much difference, at least in our work. So if you make this sort of small strain approximation, you can write the strain tensor as the derivatives of the displacements, And you can assume, or there's symmetries in the strain tensor overall, and so the strain reduces to this form of basically the on-axis and the off-axis strains that are the components that ultimately we'll want to look at. So back to the modeling, in the small deformation case, W, the strain energy function, takes the form like of this, basically. That it's the transpose of the strain times the material matrix C times strain. Interestingly, you can break that up in terms of displacement and rewrite it as long as you define things differently. This is sort of just rewriting the thing in terms of strain or displacement with a few definitions. U is the displacement vector, epsilon the strain tensor. B is a strain displacement Jacobian, a 6 by 3 for each 3 by 3 node. And you can really sort of write it in different ways with a stiffness matrix K developed from the Jacobians and the material matrix. The key modeling comes in here, and it must be defined. And it, is a 6 by 6 matrix dealing with the 1 by 6 strain tensor. So we did pretty simple things initially. So all this is sort of the model that's going to be the constraining interpolant for the what we used as the data derived for tracking the shape features, or whatever sparse data you want from image sequences. The C is a constitutive relation or material properties, and for the simple isotropic linear model reduces to this matrix, where nu is Poisson's ratio, the shear to normal strain ratio, and E is really the key, or one of these two things are the key parameters, where E is Young's modulus sent to, you know, information derived from folks who we're going to talk later here, Andrew McCulloch, Peter Hunter, Alistair Young, folks working in that area that have looked at the forward modeling of the heart. Now, we did something a little bit more than this, just to be fancy, maybe. No. I think just to try to incorporate things like what people have been thinking about in this community and the modeling, forward modeling community. And that's to say that there was work in Julius, who was here the other day, I don't know, and Andrew, there's a chapter where they just basically had a canonical model of, these are not displacement vectors now, but fiber orientations that have a smooth, small angle variation from the apex to the base and transmurally across the wall. So we took this basic model and incorporated it into the segment between the epicardium and endocardium segmented at diastole, and then carried that or propagated that over time. Now, we didn't attempt to change relationships over time, so I understand there's some issues there. But basically, by incorporating this model, along the fiber is about 4 times as stiff as across the fiber, and in these normal cases, which is sort of the base assumption, with approximate, and then we could sort of build that into the material matrix and use approximate incompressibility for Poisson's ratio. And then, so this is the basic idea. It's still linear elastic model, infinitesimal strain assumptions, but a little more, at least we played with this transversely isotropic idea to try to begin to build in some of the interesting constraints. So at the end of the day, we're going to solve what amounts to this optimization problem using a finite element method. And a couple of things here. So this is basically when you take the log of the Gaussian exponential for the data term and the Gibbs distribution for the modeling term, you end up with this for the concatenated vector U. And you can solve this analytically to this, and it looks pretty familiar, or pretty directly. It's the stiffness matrix that's the Jacobian times the material matrix that we talked about earlier. UM are the sparse measurements of whatever you have, and for us it's these shape measurements. And A is a confidence in whatever measurements you have. And so for us it was how confident, how unique is a shape match from frame to frame, and how strong is the similarity and the bending energy or the shape approximations. And then you can solve this basically by inverting those matrices, and you can solve it for you. So we've done this in a variety of data sets. I'll show a little bit here. I mean, I'm just getting to the point where there's pretty large numbers. A lot of it's data sets out of Al's dog experiments, so often open-chested, where it goes back and forth between open and closed-chested. Here's basically a baseline normal canine study, and you're seeing radial strains. So this is using these shape features, sort of just putting in, on the order of, on the order of maybe hundreds of points or to thousands of points initially, but varying, sort of fixing the scale and sort of local influence in several millimeters. And tracking the endocardial information, using the smooth information at the epicardium to track, and then getting a sequence of just from these shape matching things constrained by the FEM models, radial circumferential longitudinal strain. And interestingly, we played with this. You could back out any strain. I'll stop that so you don't go crazy. You can back out the some other interesting things. So the radial circumferential and longitudinal strains are sort of the cardiac specific coordinates. If you're willing to believe the fiber orientations and how they're carried along, we can get along and across fiber strains. And furthermore, you could back out at each point principal strains, and we've done some of that as well. So for us, we felt we needed to look at this in a particular ways and start to at least try to validate information. And while we understand that it might alter some of the myocardial performance, we wanted some live soft tissue myocardial changes in the heart. And Al developed some strategies, some was in this case out of the literature in the MR world. We could put markers, embed them in the myocardial wall. They were essentially like a box kite, I always think of it as, where there were an arrangement of things. So four markers at the epicardium, four markers at the endocardium, and four approximately mid-wall. Now they didn't always maintain that shape, but there were enough spacing that we could look at those things. And then we computed the principal strains in each of those and erased as best we could the evidence of the markers, used the shape tracking thing everywhere with the FEM model to calculate principal strains, and did this over a number of studies and looked in several different regions and found that it was pretty reasonable. Similarly, for some of the echo studies, Al's been working, and I think you mentioned it a little bit before, trying to embed the sonomicrometer arrays where the crystals talk to each other and can also back out strains. And so we've used that to compare to different data sets, especially in three-dimensional echo sequences. And these sequences were, in these early days, we used a mechanically rotating probe from Philips. So it was up at the base of the open-chested heart. The transducer rotates mechanically to try to gather fine sampling in 3D. We got the strains out of the crystal data from the sonomicrometers, and again, try to erase evidence, use the basic shape tracking with some semi-automated with plenty of intervention on the echo data, as you can imagine. To try to track that stuff. So everything's on segmented surfaces to this point. But we were quite encouraged by what we were finding. I mean, somewhat similar to what Dan was showing, where he's overlaying some of the basic ideas with things like tagging and stuff. So here's developing strain from diastole to systole radially, using, again, the same whole strategy with the basic anisotropic linear elastic model and the shape tracks in the endocardium and epicardium. So plausible strains in the radial region. And then here's the same dog, 1 hour post-LAD occlusion. And you see what in basically the perfusion bed, you're seeing strains going, to zero or going in the other direction, and the rest of the heart not changing that much. So encouraging kinds of ideas to try to begin again, quantify injury transmurally. Courtesy of Jerry and his early work, it wasn't the HARP work, and it was some 2D tagging. I think it was Bill Kerwin, right? Early ideas, early work of just sort of getting from tag data strains around just where the data intersection points were, and then from these same data, we backed out as best we could the endocardial and epicardial surfaces. And I mean, these color maps are just showing you that it's at least in the same plausible ranges. I mean, there's we worked on this and correlated it and tried to look at different things, and there was some. I mean, basically, it's okay. Needs more quantification, but just to give you sort of ballpark ideas. And then finally, we were hoping that we can at least begin to see something in actual injury. And admittedly, these models now are biased towards normality, if you will. I mean, we're not putting in disrupted fibers in what we're guessing at infarct regions. So in a sense, there's sort of whatever we might find in terms of deviation from, it's pulling it away from whatever the normal strategy is in order to look at a strains that are not normal. But again, so these were a sequence of studies, about six dogs in this case. I think a lot more have been done. And we've basically computed the strains everywhere densely. Of course, then went back and kind of wedged it into different regions and sort of averaged the regions. So in the wedge that was in three dimensions, the chunk that covered what was later found to be the injury zone, the most injured zone, you could look at the transmural and the non-transmural dogs, look at sort of a half of the wall into the endocardial and the epicardial region, and average the prints that were sort of going back and averaging parameters here. But you could look at the first, second, and third principal strains. And by these sort of bulk measurements, at least, we could distinguish non-transmural from transmural injury, at least with the first principal strain. So encouraging data, I think, to move towards trying to do this sort of work. Okay, so this is mechanically rotated transducers, where we sort of went around and, sort of initiated with some automated thing. I mean, these are tough, so we have to go back and obsess on it, try to find the boundaries, and then smooth them out, create a mesh that those boundaries, and then compute strains from it. That was what we were seeing in those earlier pictures. But interestingly, we always felt you could kind of slice across it and look at a grid. It's sort of like it's like software-based tagging, I suppose. You got to watch it whether you believe it or not. So I said, okay, what's this echo tissue tagging? Not exactly, but I mean, you could kind of cut through the grid and sort of impose it on the myocardial wall and get visualizations to see how you're doing, how plausible it is, and then get strains in all these regions from the combination of the model and the data. So before I leave this on to sort of where we looked at some other ways, there were problems with this initial model. And Xenios Papadimitris, who was one of my graduate students, he came on the faculty a couple years ago. We noticed that one of the interesting assumptions with the strain energy equations as we incorporated into this model was essentially we created what you could think of as a passive model. And it's sort of the default state is it's basically biased towards zero, as if it was dead tissue. So if you didn't have any external forces, it would relax to just some sort of like blob, like it wasn't live tissue. So that's not good, because it, for a lot of reasons, including the fact that it basically underestimated strain. So we say it can't be used, and it can't be used to incorporate prior knowledge if you sort of have it, I guess. So we propose an extension to this work, and we call it an active elastic model. It's really a data-driven active model. It's not really attempting to do real fancy things with the modeling. It's just noticing that there's a bias if we don't watch for this, that there's sort of a base strain that probably is maintained across or between frames. So we say let's decompose the overall strain into the passive strain, that's sort of the, let's say, just the dead tissue, if you will, or the fact that it's going to do something, plus this active strain. So and the passive is a function of the external forces that we apply from the data to pull on the object. And this is somehow a function of the internal work done by the object, but we're really lumping lots of things together here. And you can kind of get the idea if you look at it like this. If you rewrite, so this is just rewriting the same energy function that we talked about before, where I'm just separating it into the passive and active components. And the idea here is that it really ends up looking like this if you can add this bias. And this new function penalizes only the differences in strains from what you find somehow, we'll talk about how, the active strain EA. So if you think about it a little more, here's the strain energy function, the Gibbs distribution that I proposed earlier, the log of it goes to that. If you, the passive model is what we had done before, and it really reduced to just this, as I've already shown. What we propose to do now is to add in these biases, and we'll sort of bootstrap it and get those sort of maintaining those steady state strain biases. And if you look at the top equation, it kind of maybe helps to get the idea that if that top equation really essentially is this, it's as if you're making the bias zero, so it's sort of pulled down to zero if you don't put in some sort of prior from frame to frame. Now if you had some priors on it and you believe strains over the cycle or between any pairs of frames, you could go in and try to estimate this and then use the prior statistically on the situation. A simpler way is to sort of we just estimated it by basically running the thing, the passive strain, adjusted to produce an incompressible deformation over any two frames, and then call whatever strain that is, it's sort of the bootstrapping average strain, or better, you could sort of temporally smooth everything and then adjust it for this incompressibility. So we ran this, and this is just visual, that it's this the three cardiac specific strains, just the colors were roughly similar to what the MR tagging was doing off Jerry stuff. But I mean, so it makes some difference in the end is the idea. Here's just for a single study versus MR tagging, that if you used MR tagging as the gold standard and you're looking at strain error, I think in the radial components, the differences go like this. Here's there's more error in the purple bars where you just do assume the passive model, and the two different kind of bootstrapping for the active model brought it a little closer in these cases to the MR data. Versus the eight markers, again, the same sort of change. I mean, it wasn't huge, but it was showing that there was some interest in sort of pulling these ideas in and looking at ways to at least improve that you're not overly biasing the model, and we sort of looked at that for a while and wrote some papers on it. Okay, so that's sort of where we had been, and we're still looking at that, and sort of that's our goal is to get at, we like the biomechanical modeling, but the issues were that, a couple of things as I look at that. First off, everything to this point was pretty dependent on these and how well you could segment the surfaces, so we wanted to try to get away from that a little bit, even with these shape features. Furthermore, there's sort of some complications when we were using the FEM model, especially if we're doing things like including the papillary muscles. Well, the meshing algorithms can have trouble in here. Sometimes they don't even converge. And so that's a reason why you might want to smooth out information, I suppose. But it also might be that maybe there's alternative strategies that can help get away from that. Furthermore, just in general, at least the way we implemented the FEM, which was different versions of embedding code around Abacus and different strategies there, it was pretty computationally expensive. So basically, as new graduate students came on, we started exploring other directions that might be try to be alternatives to this. And so one of the first things we did is say, okay, let's not try to compute shape features from these surfaces, but use some rough segmentation maybe, and then look at a band of information underneath of where these approximate placements are, and try to compute the curvature features directly from the intensity information. So there's been a variety of work at this over the years. Vero Neeson was with us for a while from Utrecht, and any of you folks know they had been working on these sort of, I guess it was Bart here or Romani that had worked on it. And so we looked at this, and basically it amounts to L sub x or Ly is the first order intensity derivative in a little region around where the point you're looking at, xx means the second order derivatives. And basically you could put together curvature calculations right from the intensity off an equation like this. There's other strategies that ultimately went to where you can sort of fit different directional patches right to the
to the intensity data.
Now the modeling here, so we said, all right, well let's come out of the biomechanical modeling for the moment, or at least in our minds. Dan did a nice job of talking about the freeform deformation strategies yesterday, where basically you have this Eulerian grid, as always my interpretation of it is. You've got points inside the ventricle, those control points are going to pull on that grid. Well, at least my view is there are some issues of trying to hold on to outside information. Maybe one way at least to slightly get around that, but it's still, you're not necessarily really meshing the Lagrangian ventricle. You're sort of creating an equally spaced grid within it. But people have worked on so-called extended freeform deformation, where you create the FFD grid just within the object itself, in this case maybe with some radially concentric sampling strategies. So this was Ning Lin, a student of mine, and he worked on, here's some dog hearts. We went underneath the rough segmented information, thresholded by that intensity-based curvature operator, laid down a mesh only at time one, or a grid, I'll call it, and then used the curvature derived from the intensities to match these two frames, pull it to the next one, match the next two frames, pull it to the next one, and then moving on out. So it's the extended freeform deformation idea. It's actually kind of embedded in this case in a global matching framework that looks like this. So it's energy functions that I apologize, I thought to do this, but I couldn't do it in time. You could probably re-embed this in the probabilistic framework, but for the sake of our chronology here, we basically popped out of the probabilistic estimation idea, went back to an energy function, that basically was parameterized by this extended freeform deformation. And then the matching went on like this. There was sort of a proximity matching, a curvature matching from these intensity features, a smoothing, if you will, that's basically just a regularization term of the mapping F, and then a robustness control term. So this came out of, it's actually a form of an iterative closest point that Anand Rangarajan and our group had worked on called robust point matching. So it takes the collection of features, tries to do the best to match to the features at the next frame, rejects the ones that don't contribute to the overall matching, does some smoothing, and you do this with a deterministic annealing in order to make it converge, going from a sort of a coarse to a fine scale. So that method's called generalized robust point matching. Okay, so the idea here in 2D is here's the grid laid down at time one. The points are near, but not necessarily on wherever that grid was. It's sort of a rough segmentation. It's just the green circles that are used for matching between the red and the blue things superimposed on each other. If you didn't use this shape, you wouldn't get anything plausible. If you use shape plus distance in that metric, you begin to get the evidence of the twisting that should be in there. We did it in 3D, even with echo data. We're being pretty bold here, I suppose. This is open-chested dog data. Now we're moving to a different modality. I'll talk a little bit about that later, but we now have a Philips 2D array probe. I think it's called an X-matrix probe on a Philips 7500 scanner. Went in there and segmented and meshed, did a rough segmentation at time one, actually calculated these shape features from the B-mode data, and then again got this sort of progression of strain development both radially and circumferentially to try to use this different strategy. And it was plausible. So now, I guess the point here that I didn't mention is it's a huge computational speed up. I mean, from the hour plus that it took with the FEM work, now we're down to minutes, but of course, there's some accuracy issues. There's a gross segmentation. Maybe we can readjust it. We can try to get this grid moving. It's not really a meshing of the so accurately. But the strains that come out are plausible. It's roughly constrained to the mesh. You'll see something interesting here, though, is that so the red or the orange and the yellow are all probably true strains, but because this is sort of only grossly segmented to lay down the initial grid, it's probably outside the ventricle, and so there's some funny calculations right around that part of the endocardium. Okay, so I'll kind of come back and sort of look at some of this in a second, but I think we felt that that was an interesting time-wise computational excursion. We liked the idea of going back and not using segmented surfaces, but underlying intensity information to try to get at some tracking features related to shape. But I think we wanted to come back to the physical modeling framework. So this is one attempt at a joke. It's something like matrix reloaded or physical modeling reloaded. But come back to the biomechanics a bit, but maybe in some compromised position where it's not as costly and maybe as difficult with some of the meshing. So we went explored Ping Yan, who's a student of mine in the audience, has been looking at using boundary element strategies, and I'll talk about this. And I mean, if not, you might just take away that this is a cavalcade of different strategies that could be used, and they have different pluses and minuses. One way to categorize it might be like this. If here's the kind of compute time, and it takes more to compute generally, at least in our experience, things related to higher or more truer, let's say, biomechanical models, so the accuracy of the model goes up, probably with the computation time, or at least in our experience. The FFD on the square sample grid might be computationally pretty good, might be less realistic in terms of the biomechanics. This boundary element strategy is somewhere in between, and so that's what we were trying to get at with this. And we had, I mean, if you look at the numbers of nodes and the number of frames and how many nodes on the boundary and inside, I mean, at least roughly for sort of half the cycle, we were, on our methods, we were looking at these kinds of plausibilities for some of these calculations, and where it might go from 5 minutes to 60 minutes or more. Okay, so this is back to what I was just talking about, but I'm going to re-embed it in the boundary elements thing, so I thought I'd recap. We have two images at two different time frames. We're going to extract feature point sets using these shape markers in this case. There's a correspondence matrix, M, that's extracted that sort of matches all the points between the frames, robustly throwing out anything that doesn't contribute to the matching. We're going to match point sets A and B using this transformation module and deterministic techniques, and we'll cycle back in order to do that. I mean, in a sense, there's different choices at each of these points. We use these underlying sort of shape near the boundary point, but in theory you could use tagging or speckles or whatever. At this point you could use different metrics for matching some kind of similarity in curvature or intensity or speckle patterns or even distances away from each point. I think the model that you use to constrain the transformation could be based on the full physical model, as we were talking about earlier, or maybe down to a more B-spline-based model that probably makes some underlying physical assumptions, whether you like it or not, and then the BDM thing somewhere in between. And then this, just for this algorithm, talks about this annealing temp parameter as we move across. Okay, so briefly for the boundary element strategy. The idea here is that we have a little bit different thinking. I don't know, maybe some of you in the mechanics world know a bit about this, but it had some interesting advantages here about how we might get at sort of reincorporating some of the boundary element stuff and a little bit the physical modeling stuff in a bit quicker way. So let's say here's the epicardium, the endocardium, roughly. We have a sparse set of data points, we'll call them A, these red points, and the quality points may show up maybe near the boundary if we've got the shape tracking, but in theory we could have mid-wall points if we're getting this from MR tagging, or as what we're after in this case is from speckle tracking, and I'll just show a little bit later on. The blue points have to do with a set of boundary points, we'll call them Q, and then there's a reimposing or reinterpolating across the dense grid. So these are data points, these are some sampling of just the boundary points, and then this is re-spreading out the information over the entire dense surface. It's at whatever positions you'd like. with the boundary element strategy, so it's derived from the Navier equations, not Navier-Stokes, it's fluid mechanics. This is the Navier-elastic equations. And basically, it amounts to, or you can, it reduces to something like this, where U are the sets of displacements on the boundary points Q, P are tractions or forces that hold it onto the boundary, and H and G are basically interpolation matrices that are back out. They end up being related on proximity and rough shape functions and material properties incorporated between are related to the same Poisson's ratio and Young's modulus that we talked about in the FEM models. So these are basically, H and G are interpolation functions related to the material matrix C and geometric interpolation. H prime and G prime are the same functions. This relates information only on the boundary. This relates information in any internal point. And so you can measure these U Qs, as we'll talk about in a second, or at least you can project measurements on their boundaries, and you can back out these traction forces. And so basically for any internal point, UA, okay, the displacement at any point in the middle of those of the myocardium in this case, you can map that back and forth onto the boundary under these traction forces and displacements on the boundary by these interpolating matrices G prime and H prime. And then you can write P in terms of just G and H, and you end up with a function that looks like this. So what this amounts to is the back and forth equation that gets internal points projected onto the internal point displacements projected onto the boundary. So what's the effect of a displacement internally mapped or projected onto the boundaries via an interpolation matrix that has to do with roughly shape or geometry and material properties, similar to the linear elastic models we talked about. So to briefly try to look at it, just to give you a feel, that's that same mapping equation. Suppose we have a point here, AI. We can project it by inverting this equation with a pseudo-inverse to the boundary. So it says whatever I'm moving here or displacing here, I can map the effect onto the two boundaries by this interpolation function that ends up being like this. So this is the effect on any given boundary point, QJ of any given boundary point, on any internal point displacement. The collection of them are the effect everywhere. So we can say, all right, let's look if we've got the effects of those of any point AI on any one point on all boundary points. We can get the effect of all points on any boundary point. So project any displacements in the middle of the ventricle to the total effect on the boundaries. Save it up as UQ. And then ultimately use the same interpolation information. So it's basically take the displacement mid-ventricle, project the effect of the boundaries, collect all those effects, and then reinterpolate it back onto the dense field. So it sounds like a bit involved here, but it's basically the computational speed up. You don't have to go to Abacus. You can implement this fairly directly. And it's sort of assuming that there's a certain homogeneity in the middle of the ventricle, and it's just the walls where you're doing the sampling.
Yeah, do you close that back to make a difference? Do you go from C back to A, where you actually have some data?
I mean, you could. As like a check or something like that, right? It's a good point. Yeah, that would be a validation strategy.
I'm basically doing it for speed, I guess, right? By taking out the rotational movement.
The rotational parameter. Same idea, except it's not Navier-Stokes. But same idea.
Well, that's cool because I think it's faster.
It is, yeah. No, it is. That's the idea. And I mean, it's, as I show, it's kind of a compromised position. We want to get the physical modeling back in there, but maybe try to get something that might be more efficient. Okay, so we ran this on some of Al's dog data here with the points and the boundaries. Here it is projected out and reinterpolated just to show you some of the displacements in a cut through a 3D problem. We're just sort of getting into this, but this is similar open chest data. one of the dogs where there wasn't much going on in the epicardium, although the, again, the segmentation is just gross and not necessarily completely accurate. So it's using the underlying intensity-based curvatures. And we're getting at least plausible strains, both radially and circumferentially. And I mean, you know, we're working on this. But I think the idea is that, well, you got the idea. And I think that the we're hoping that we can reincorporate it and then read back out the probabilistic strategy.
So, from that strategy, is the boundary measurable?
Say that again?
The boundary measurable.
Yeah, yeah. So this is, so we haven't, I haven't talked anything really about temporal smoothing like Dan was talking about, and we haven't really done too much there. But we, this is, we're just basically doing frame-to-frame deformation and then collecting it all. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, whatever, it's pulled from the starting position to the next thing, it all deforms and changes. It's pulled to the next thing, et cetera. Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, we've done just bands of chunks of things, I guess. Ping, do you want to comment? Have you done the whole ventricle or just this chunk so far, I think? Mm-hmm. You did do the whole ventricle. And you didn't end up with the, what he's talking about? Mm-hmm. What is, I mean, I would have thought it, yeah, it might get tricky too, but, well, we can talk about it. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the kind of trade-off I want to see about, I mean, it's hard because you're not always comparing completely apples with apples, because, I mean, the whole FEM thing, we've got it embedded in an abacus thing. This is sort of offline implemented, and I'm worried that we're being unfair as we're comparing them anyway.
So are you using any of the shape information from the endocardium and so forth?
Yeah, yeah, this is all the shape stuff is what's pushing.
What problem is the shape? Pointed out earlier, there are very little distinguishing features on the epicardial surface.
Right.
So we would look at the mesh to see the insides moving around a bit. Most
right.
constrained by papillae must be the only big
right.
feature. There's nothing moving on the outside, so there's no artificial components there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we get some. There is some.
It's exactly what you're trying to see.
Yeah, and that one is pretty bad. But remember, these are not. So a little bit, let me try to say that in the earlier work, you were seeing as best as we could segment surfaces. And then those features were being used to move things. Here, it's like a gross segmentation and features underlying in the intensities are what are pulling it along. So it's this trade-off of do we need to accurately segment to show what's really going on. There's motion out there, we're maybe not representing it well here. But but in general, it's true. I mean, the epicardium is pretty smooth. There are some slight features, and we can get at them a bit. But as long as you can segment, you'll be able to see what's you know, what's changing in terms of you know, the overall scaling, but you may not capture some subtle rotational component for sure. Okay, so finally I'll wrap up with where we like the grand scheme of putting things together, but we'd like to compare across some of these strategies. Our heart, no pun intended, is probably with the finite element ideas, or at least the physical modeling ideas in general. We find boundary element as a possible sort of maybe path that might gain some computational improvement. But what we'd like to do is put together a system, perhaps as others, where our key issue is we'd like to add mid-wall information, and I'll talk about that a little bit, a collaboration that we're doing. And we want to put it a system block diagram. We're going to pull it back into a probabilistic framework. So this is sort of the current idea. We've got a collaboration with Matt O'Donnell at University of Michigan. Kong Chan, one of his students, is here. And we want to. And his ideas are that he wants to get at the raw RF, and he's been pretty successful in the elastography world of taking raw radio frequency data before it's B-mode envelope detected and use that as the tracking mechanism for speckle matching. And so we've got this idea of, can we sort of get a segmentation as best as we can get. The speckle tracking actually has trouble. It breaks up around boundaries. If we can get some decent boundary information, we can use the shape tracking as a constraint. Put it all back together in some dense field estimate. Maybe we can, even if we have algo in, at least in the dogs, or we can get some sort of mid-ventricular pressures and do some assumptions about bootstrapping with incompressibility. Maybe we can even get at material parameters, although we'll see about that. I don't have too much to say about that. But the idea is that we would like to come back in the same probabilistic framework that we started with. H is a collection of parameters that segment the endocardial and epicardial boundaries over all time. U dense is displacement vectors everywhere. And we're truly trying to estimate these things in the same way that I started out from a collection or an image sequence I. So here's, you love this. It's like, but I mean, here's my attempt at sort of backing out using Bayes' rule repeatedly. But I think even if you just look at the things underneath the braces, it's basically, it reduces to a likelihood term that some kind of data. So we want to go back and forth between segmentation and deformation or displacement estimation. And so we can sort of a min-max strategy is what we have in mind, and we're sort of just starting this and implemented some basic pieces of it. But on the tracking piece, we've got speckle tracking that I'll talk about in a second, we hope. We've got the shape tracking term. So these are the data terms, and the same idea as what I talked about earlier. The mechanical models implemented in the same strain energy function, perhaps boundary element or finite element approach. And then we've at least got frame-to-frame smoothing incorporated in that. And if you lay down a grid at time one, then there's you can go back and forth and use that as a prior for the segmentation of the next frame. And I think others, Dan and Bodeman, were maybe talking about this. But you could have shape priors in here for the segmentation. So if you can kind of get going, get some displacement vectors, you can use that to pass the surfaces along and kind of have this back and forth between segmentation and displacement estimation where one is helping the other. So the thing I'll end on is just that this initial work with Matt on speckle tracking that we've been pretty excited about and sort of getting going, and we at least have some initial data. So this is his equation. Basically, it's the correlation coefficient of the correlation of two complex images at times t and t plus one. And the idea here, what we have at least, is this array sensor. At the moment, we're imaging about a quarter of the myocardial volume. Each beam coming back before its envelope detected looks like this. And the idea is that as you do the correlation of information, which has really good resolution on the order of 300-400 microns, actually maybe 1 or 2 millimeters, he's saying, radially, we can use not only the amplitude, but the phase in order to match information. So here's let me set this up for you. This is from Matt's lab. And this is the septum of a porcine heart between points A and B. And what you're gonna see is somebody just manually drew that between there, and it's sort of warped to a flat line here. So A and B and A and B. And you're just seeing accumulated axial displacement and accumulated lateral displacement. And if you can see it from the back, there's a red point there. And all he's doing then is this is at a high rate though now. I mean, because he doesn't want to lose lock on the correlation coefficient. He's got sampling at about 90 hertz here. And the idea is that by doing these frame-to-frame correlations in this complex space, maintaining the phase, that then you just go along here and you can look up anywhere in that line the axial and the lateral displacement, and you can just follow that point along. And you'll see that it does pretty good. This is just a 2D version of it. And he's computing strain rate, so the derivative of strain along there. So it's just, it's each time point, wherever it started, it's just looking up these and pointing that vector down and tracking it and returning it, and it does a decent job. So, of course, this is in 2D. We've got this 3D data, these 3D data. And finally began a look, at least in these quarter volumes of the closed open chest dog hearts. Endocardium's about here, epicardium's about there. You're looking at sort of a chunk here. And now the theory is, or the idea he feels is that we can get down about less, maybe half. So we looked at this about, we've got full 3D coherence. These are around 45 hertz frame rates. And what you're seeing here is, this is the correlation coefficient plotted. So there's nothing moving down here, it all correlates well. There's the band within the myocardium. It holds pretty well. And here you're just, these are the three lookup maps, wherever you want to look along there, axially, whatever they call it, lateral elevational and axial. And basically at any point you can look up and get that 3D displacement vector. So early in the work, but some promising work that we can see this coherence at that frame rate. And we're exactly working on trying to track that and sort of use the constraints of the shape tracking to put it all together. Okay, so I'll just conclude. I think, our approaches have been that there's a variety of imaging modalities, certainly maybe useful in different situations and maybe different models. We like to move, and we still, in our group, certainly are headed towards wanting to do physical modeling and looking at different strategies that might be less challenging computationally. The models, though, still, biomechanical models that tend to be simple and linear, and maybe there's still lots of issues, and I'll hand this off this afternoon, maybe Alistair will talk about it, that there's lots of trade-offs between model complexity, maybe adding nonlinear effects, accuracy, robustness, and then computational efficiency is in there somewhere. We've typically just included normal structure as the bias. Maybe we can get in there even in these different models if we can find or segment out approximate injury zones and do something different. Validation, evaluation, motherhood, and apple pie, we need to do it some way. And in general, I guess for us, MR is certainly important, but we've had fun looking at 4D echo and feel that it's promising and we can bring some of this computational power, or ideas, I should say, for that. Lots of folks involved here, Xenios, older students, Ping Chang, Ping Hao, and I have had a long time collaboration. It's really been fun. We're starting to work with Matt Moore and Jeff Powers at Phillips, and thanks to Jerry and Andrew, who's, I guess, coming later, who've given us some advice and some help in doing some of the validation work. Thanks a lot.